Chapter 6. His name was Franklin Fearson. He was the second spy I ever met in my life, and he was hungry for knowledge. He came to me in my fourth life in 1968. I was working as a doctor in Glasgow, and my wife had left me. I was 50 years old, and I was a broken man. Her name was Jenny, and I loved her and told her everything. She was a surgeon, one of the first female surgeons on the ward. I was a neurologist with a reputation for unorthodox and occasionally unethical, though legal, research. She believed in God. I did not. Much must be said of my third life, but for now, let me say simply that my third death, alone in a hospital in Japan, had convinced me of the truth of nothingness. I had lived, and I had died, and not Allah, Jehovah, Krishna, Buddha, nor the spirits of my ancestors had descended to take away my fear, but rather I had been born again exactly where I had begun, back in the snow, back in England, back in the past where it had all begun. My loss of faith was not revelatory, nor intensely distressing. It was a prolonged growth of resignation, one which the events of my life had only reinforced, until I was forced to conclude that any conversations I had with a deity were entirely one way. My death and subsequent rebirth back where I had begun rounded the argument off with a sort of weary inevitability, and I viewed it with all the disappointment and detachment of a scientist whose test tubes had failed to precipitate. I had spent an entire life praying for a miracle, and none had come. And now I looked at the stuffy chapel of my ancestors and saw vanity and greed, heard the call to prayer and thought of power, smelled incense and wondered at the waste of it all. In my fourth life, I turned away from God and sought out science for an explanation. I studied as no man has studied before, physics, biology, philosophy, and at the last fought with every tool at my disposal to become the poorest boy in Edinburgh University, graduating top of my class as a doctor. Jenny was drawn to my ambition, and I to hers, for the ignorant had snickered the first time she took up a scalpel, until they saw the precision of her cuts and the confidence with which she wielded a blade. We'd been together for 10 years in unfashionable but politically pointed sin, before marrying in 1963, in that swell of relief that followed the Cuban Missile Crisis, and it had rained, and she had laughed and said we both deserved it, and I had been in love. So in love that one night, for no very special reason and without much very special thought, I told her everything. I said, "My name is Harry August. My father is Rory Edmund Hune. My mother died before I was born. This is my fourth life. I have lived, and I have died many times before now. But it is always the same life." She punched me in the chest playfully and told me to stop being daft. I said, "In a matter of weeks, a scandal is going to break in the US which will topple President Nixon. Capital punishment will be abolished in England, and Black September terrorists will open fire in Athens Airport." She said, "You should be on the news, you should." 3 weeks later, Watergate broke. It broke gently at first, aides sacked across the sea. By the time capital punishment had been abolished, President Nixon was in front of congressional hearings, and when Black September terrorists gunned down travellers in Athens Airport, it was obvious to all that Nixon was on the way out. Jenny sat on the end of the bed, shoulders bowed and head low. I waited. It was an expectation that had been 4 lifetimes in the making. She had a bony back and a warm belly, hair cut deliberately short to challenge the conceptions of her surgeon colleagues, and a soft face that loved to laugh when no one was looking. She said, "How did you know all of this? How did you know it would happen?" "I told you," I replied. "This is the fourth time I've lived it, and I have an excellent memory."
"What does that mean? The fourth time? How is it possible the fourth time?
I don't know. I became a doctor to try and find out. I've run experiments on myself, studied my blood, my body, my brain, tried to see if there is something in me which isn't right. But I was wrong. It's not a medical problem, or if it is, I don't yet know how to find the answer. I would have left this job long ago, tried something new, but I met you. I have forever, but I want you now.
How old are you? She demanded.
I'm 54. I'm 206.
I can't believe what you're seeing. I can't believe that you believe.
I'm sorry.
Are you a spy?
No.
Are you ill?
No, not by any handbook definition.
Then why?
Why what?
Why would you see these things?
It's the truth. I want to tell you the truth. She crawled onto the bed next to me, took my face into her hands, stared deeply into my eyes.
Harry,
she said, and there was fear in her voice.
I need you to tell me. Do you mean what you're seeing?
Yes, I replied, and the relief of it nearly burst me open from the inside out.
Yes, I do.
She left me that night, pulling her coat on over her shift and slipping into a pair of Wellington boots. She went to stay with her mother, who lived in North Ferry, just beyond Dundee, and left me a note on the table saying she needed time. I gave her a day, then called. Her mother told me to stay away. I gave it another day and called again, begging Jenny to ring me. On the third day when I rang, the phone had been disconnected. Jenny had taken the car, so I caught the train to Dundee and a taxi the rest of the way. The weather was beautiful, the sea perfectly still against the shore, the sun low and pink and too interested in the moment to want to set. Jenny's mother's cottage was a little white thing with a child-sized front door set back from the edge of a charcoal cliff. When I knocked, her mother, a woman perfectly designed to fit through that implausibly low door, answered and held it open on the chain.
"She can't see you," she blurted. "I'm sorry, but you have to go away."
"I need to see her," I begged. "I need to see my wife."
"You have to leave now, Dr. August," she exclaimed. "I'm sorry it's this way, but you clearly need help."
She closed the door sharply, the latch clicking behind the creaking white wood. I stayed there and hammered on the door, then on the windows, pressing my face against the glass. They turned off the lights inside, so I wouldn't know where they were, or perhaps hoping I'd get bored and go away. The sun set, and I sat on the porch and wept and called out for Jenny, begged her to speak to me, until finally her mother phoned the police and they did the talking instead. I was put in a cell with a man brought in for burglary. He laughed at me, and I throttled him to within a few heartbeats from death. Then they put me in a solitary cell and left me there for a day, until at last a doctor came to see me and asked how I was feeling. He listened to my chest, which I pointed out in my calmest possible voice was hardly a rational approach to diagnosing mental illness. "Do you consider yourself mentally ill?" he asked quickly. "No," I snapped. "I can just recognize a bad doctor." They must have rushed the paperwork through, because I was taken to the asylum the very next day. I laughed when I saw it. The name on the door was St. Margot's Asylum. Someone had scrubbed out "for unfortunates," leaving an ugly grammatical gap. It was the hospital I had thrown myself from in my second life at the age of 7 years old.